Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Okay, so today we're going to be doing heart failure, which is pretty important for the board, so you do need to be familiar with it. I'm going to give you some ways to remember the things that you need to know and just focus on the high-yield stuff for today. As always, thank you so much for the reviews, the likes, and thank you for everybody that's checked out my YouTube page as well. Seeing a lot of positive comments coming in there, so it's definitely much appreciated. And if you wouldn't mind leaving me a like or a review on either Apple Podcasts or my YouTube channel, I would really appreciate it if it is helping you. So let's get started with heart failure. So what is heart failure? I'm sure all of us are pretty familiar with this, but heart failure is a clinical syndrome that results from either a structural or a functional disorder of the heart. So you have either an impairment of the filling of the heart or an impairment of the ability of the heart to adequately pump blood. Now, predisposing factors, there's one that you really have to know, that you have to be familiar with, because it's the most common cause overall. About 60 to 65% of cases of heart failure, the predisposing factor is coronary artery disease. So absolutely know that one, coronary artery disease. That's really important. Majority of cases are from that. So a few more that you need to be familiar with. Hypertension and valvular heart disease, like aortic stenosis, are big ones, but they're becoming less prevalent as the years go on due to improvements in early detection and treatment, but they are still predisposing factors. Diabetes, obesity, and then of course the less common causes like doxorubicin and dilated cardiomyopathy, amyloidosis and restrictive cardiomyopathy. But overall, if you remember coronary artery disease, you'll probably get the question right on the exam. So the next thing you need to know is the different types of heart failure. So that's important as well, because that's going to help you understand the clinical manifestations and treatment options and things like that. So obviously we have different parts of the heart. And like I said, the clinical manifestations are all dictated relating to the part of the heart that is affected. So first, let's start with the sides of the heart. We have a right and we have a left side of the heart. And the first thing that you should be aware of is that while you can only have like exclusive left-sided heart failure, you can have exclusive right-sided heart failure, it's actually not that common. It's more common for both to coexist. So most of the time you're going to have right and left-sided heart failure at the same time, but it is possible to just have left-sided only heart failure. Normally in like an acute MI, so coronary artery disease, long-standing hypertension. And then it's also possible to just have right-sided exclusive heart failure in patients with pulmonary disorders like pulmonary hypertension, COPD. And actually the most common cause of right-sided heart failure is actually left-sided heart failure. And why is that? Well, if we think about the patho, it makes more sense. We already discussed that pulmonary disorders like pulmonary hypertension can lead to right-sided heart failure. And that's because you have this increased pressure in the lungs, the right side of the heart is pumping blood to the lungs. So you have this increased pressure in the lungs. It's going to hypertrophy the right side of the heart, make it harder for it to pump, and it leads to heart failure. So think about left-sided heart failure now causing right-sided heart failure. Well, left-sided heart failure, the fluid's backing up into where it came from, which is the lungs. So left-sided heart failure is causing all this excess fluid to back up into the lungs. All that excess fluid is going to increase the pressure in the lungs, which is going to lead to ultimately right-sided heart failure. So that's why left-sided heart failure is actually the most common cause of right-sided heart failure, because of all that backed up fluid increasing the pressure, right side having to pump harder, and ultimately leading to a hypertrophy of the right side of the heart and other problems leading to heart failure. So that's the right and the left side of the heart. That's the different variations with heart failure with that. The other variation you're going to see is systolic and diastolic dysfunction, or systolic and diastolic heart failure. Now, the terms that they use for these are systolic is heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, and diastolic is heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So that's the proper way to say these, but I'm not going to say that because it takes too long. So if I say systolic, think of heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, diastolic, preserved ejection fraction. So let's start with systolic, aka heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. So systolic is a pumping problem. The ventricles, for whatever reason, have become weak and baggy. They're stretched out. They can't pump the way they used to. They're just baggy. They have no strength anymore, much, a decreased strength. And normally, this is going to be a post-MI patient, dilated cardiomyopathy. But just think, in systolic, you have these weak, baggy ventricles. They can't pump the way they used to. And because of that, you have this decreased ejection fraction. An ejection fraction, if you're not familiar with it, it's the measurement of volume of blood that's pumped out of the left ventricle with each contraction. Normally, is a normal patient's going to be around 50 to 70%. These patients are generally going to be actually under 40% ejection fraction. So systolic, you're going to have decreased ejection fraction. And then on a physical exam, be familiar that they may have an S3 gallop. So an S3 gallop is from the blood coming from the atrium that's hitting this very compliant or left baggy left ventricle. So S3 gallop, you're going to see it in systolic heart failure. And also know that S3 can be normal in athletes, pregnant women, children, but in the presence of heart failure, it's because of all this blood hitting this baggy or compliant left ventricle. Now, diastolic heart failure, which is heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So as it says, preserved, the ejection fraction is normally not decreased. You have the opposite. The ventricles are actually stiff. They're sometimes thickened. They can't relax. So the problem's not with pumping, but it's with receiving blood. They can't expand to fill the blood during diastole. They're stiffened. They're thick. So again, it's not a pumping problem. So ejection fraction is normally either normal or sometimes even elevated. The ventricles just can't expand to fill with adequate blood, which can also cause backup and heart other problems with heart failure as well. And in diastolic, you're normally going to hear an S4 gallop. So S4 gallop is because it occurs during left ventricular filling when the atrial contraction forces blood into this non-compliant left ventricle. And the thing about an S4 gallop is it's rarely a normal finding. So if you hear an S4 or you see an S4 on an exam, don't think that, well, maybe it's normal. It's almost never normal. It's almost always pathological. So S4 gallop in diastolic, and that's from the blood hitting that non-compliant left ventricle. And diastolic heart failure, you're normally going to see in different cardiomyopathies, valvular heart disease, hypertension. Those are some of the predisposing factors for that. So again, systolic is a pumping problem. You have this baggy ventricle, it can't pump blood out. Diastolic, you have this stiffened, thick ventricle that can't receive blood. It can't fill the way it used to. It can't get as much blood in there, but no problem pumping. So ejection fraction is preserved. Now, clinical manifestations, well, it's all related to whether it's right or left-sided heart failure. And remember what I said before, that normally these are going to coexist. So most of the time, you're going to see symptoms of both right and left-sided heart failure. But again, it's possible to have just exclusive right or left-sided heart failure. So in both right and left-sided heart failure, the blood is backing up. So whether it's systolic, the ventricles don't pump enough blood out, or diastolic, the ventricles don't relax, can't receive all the blood from the atrium. Both cases, you have this backing up of blood, and the symptoms are all related to where it's backing up to. So if you have, and it's basically where it came from. So if you have left-sided heart failure, well, what's providing the left side of the heart with blood? the pulmonary veins from the lungs. So if you have left-sided heart failure, the blood's going to back up into the pulmonary vein and back into the lungs. And that's why with left-sided heart failure, the most common symptom is going to be dyspnea, because you have these lungs full of fluid. Orthopnea is another big one. Orthopnea is dyspnea while lying flat. So these patients lay down, within a few minutes, they're out of breath and they're coughing. So they may have a chronic cough as well. They may have some frothy pink sputum that can be seen. So left-sided heart failure is all related to the lungs. And you can remember that by L for left-sided heart failure, think of lungs. So as soon as you see left-sided heart failure, think of lungs. All pulmonary symptoms like that. That's because, again, left side of the heart connects to the lungs. It's going to back up into the lungs where it came from. Now, right side of the heart, the way I remember that, L, left-sided, is for lungs. R is going to be rest of the body, because it's going to go everywhere else, the rest of the body. So R, so what provides the right side of the heart with blood? It's the inferior vena cava and the superior vena cava, which connect to pretty much everything. So these patients are going to have peripheral edema. They may have like pitting edema in the legs, jugular venous distension. It's because the blood from the right atrium is backing up into the jugular vein. So you take a look at their neck, you'll see this distended jugular vein. Blood can also back up into the GI system, the liver. They may have nausea, vomiting, something known as hepatojugular reflux, which is when you push on the liver, you palpate the liver and push into it, it actually causes an increased JVP. So you push on their liver and you look at their neck and all of a sudden you see the jugular venous distended, the jugular vein distended. So those are your clinical manifestations of the right and the left sides. Remember, left side lungs, right side is going to be rest of the body. But again, most of the time these are going to coexist. So you're normally going to have both. One other thing I wanted to mention before we move on to diagnosis is something that I don't think is that important, but it's very easy to remember. So in the case they ask you one question, let's just go over it really quick, because it's pretty easy to memorize. So that's the New York Heart Association functional class. So these are four classes that are used to somewhat guide treatment and different therapies. But you just need to know a few things to be able to remember this for the exam. So there's four classes. There's class 1, 2, 3, and 4. As you move along in the classes, the symptoms get worse. So let's knock out class 1 and 4 really quick, because those are the easiest. So class 1, New York Heart Association functional class. Class 1, no symptoms. They have heart failure, but they have no symptoms. No problems at all. Class 4, they're going to have symptoms even at rest. So they're sitting down, they're laying down, they can't breathe, they're having all of these problems. It never gets better. Even when they're resting, they're having symptoms. So that's class 1 and 4. Remember, 1, no symptoms. 4, symptoms even at rest. Class 3 is going to be their only comfortable at rest. They have even their regular daily activities, their ADLs, their activities of daily living, walking around, doing the dishes, minor things that you and me would have no issues with. They're having dyspnea and problems even with that. They're only comfortable at rest. And then class 2 is kind of in between. They're going to have mild symptoms. Most of their ADLs, they're going to be okay. If they exert themselves a little bit more, they may start to develop some symptoms. They're not completely asymptomatic like class 1. They just have mild symptoms. So again, class 1, no symptoms. Class 4, symptoms at rest. Class 3, only comfortable at rest. And then class 2 is just basically mild symptoms. That's your New York Heart Association class. Remember, if you don't memorize that, it's fine. It's very easy to remember, but you may or may not get maybe one question on that. All right, so let's move on to diagnosis. There's really four diagnostic tests that you need to be familiar with. Those four tests, your best test is going to be an echo. Your first test, like your initial test, is going to be a chest x-ray. And then a couple other labs, like your BNP and then an ECG. So let's start and move our way down the line. So let's do your first test. If they ask you what's your initial test you'll do for a patient suspecting heart failure, it's going to be a chest x-ray. Now, chest x-ray is not diagnostic for congestive heart failure. It's just not specific enough, but it is a good initial test. And what are you going to see on a chest x-ray that you need to know to suspect congestive heart failure? Well, there's something known as cephalization of flow. Cephalization of flow. And what this is due to all the backflow of blood into the lungs, you have this increased pulmonary pressure, which actually causes the vascular flow to migrate up the lungs and go all the way to the apices. So because of the cephalization of flow, you're going to have two key findings, those key terms that you need to be familiar with that you need to know caused from the cephalization of flow. That's curly B lines, K-E-R-L-E-Y B lines, and then butterfly or bat wing appearance in chest x-ray. Of course, you're going to have cardiomegaly, pleural effusion, but they're not going to ask you a question about that. They're going to ask you about these key findings. So what are curly B lines? These are due to lymphatic engorgement or edema at the lung periphery, so at the sides of the lungs in a congestive heart failure patient. And at the sides or the periphery of the lungs on chest x-ray, you're going to see these short, little, tiny 1 to 2 centimeter thin lines. So these 1 to 2 centimeters, little radio opaque lines that most of the time, unless you're pretty good at reading chest x-rays, you probably completely miss. But a radiologist will see that and know that it's related to congestive heart failure. Potentially, there's other causes again. And the other thing you should be familiar with is something known as bat wing or butterfly appearance. This is better with a visual. So check out my YouTube channel. I'm going to have pictures of all of these when I'm going through the video. But this is another cause from the accumulation of fluid. But in these cases, the fluid is filling the hilar and the perihilar region of the lungs. And because of the location of the edema, you're going to have this bat wing appearance with these white opacities in the lungs. And it looks like the wings of a bat wing or a bird or whatever you want to think, a butterfly. So it's just the location of the fluid overloaded in the lungs. So that's the initial test that you'll do. Again, it's not really going to be diagnostic, but it's a good first test to kind of give you an idea that maybe this patient does have CHF. Okay, so another initial test that you'll do, especially if they're coming into the ER, is something known as BNP. You'll also hear it known as proBNP, and that is either B-type natriuretic peptide. It also used to be called brain natriuretic peptide, but as the newer name for it is B-type natriuretic peptide. So what this is, BNP is this peptide that's secreted by the heart to regulate blood pressure and fluid in the body. And it's released when you have the ventricle stretching. So that's the body's way of knowing, okay, the ventricles are stretching, we're being overloaded from fluid. They don't exactly know why. So they release this and it's pumped out to kind of regulate and make some changes in the blood pressure and regulate the fluids in the body. Now, BNP is also pumped out during renal failure. It can be decreased in obese patients. So it's not 100% specific, but it's a good rule out test, because if you do a BNP in a patient you suggest has heart failure and it's zero or it's completely normal, less than 100, it's a good chance that they don't have heart failure. Generally, the number that you're looking for is a BNP over 100. You should be thinking there's a pretty good chance that this patient could have heart failure. So BNP over 100, you should be suspecting heart failure, but be aware there's other things that can elevate it as well. So that's another good lab test to do. And it's really good in guiding treatment when you have like decompensated heart failure to see the response to treatment. But you should know that one as well. That's your BNP or proBNP. Another one that's, it's not a bad test, but it's, again, not going to be diagnostic, is your ECG. So it's another good rule out test. And the reason it's a good rule out test is because if this patient has systolic heart failure, so heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, if they have a normal ECG, there's a very small chance that they have heart failure. It's a 98% predictive value if it's negative that they don't have heart failure. So, but on the flip side of that, if they have preserved ejection fraction, a lot of times the ECG is going to be normal. So again, a good rule out test for systolic, but not so much for diastolic. And again, if it's positive, if you do see abnormalities on ECG, doesn't mean it's heart failure. So another good rule out test, but again, not diagnostic. Now, the best test overall is going to be your echo. So your echo is going to measure your ejection fraction. It's going to measure or evaluate the ventricular wall, see if they're thinning, like in systolic heart failure. It's going to be able to get a really good idea of the function of the heart and to diagnose heart failure. So overall, echo is going to be your best test. That's the one you really need to be familiar with and know for the exam if they do ask you what your best test is. Okay, so let's move on to treatment. Obviously, there's a lot of different meds you need to know, but initially, when you have a patient with heart failure, you're going to do a few lifestyle changes. So the first thing is these patients cannot smoke anymore. Smoking cessation is really important. And then there's some dietary changes. These patients can become fluid overloaded very easily. So you want to restrict not only their sodium, but their fluid intake as well. You don't want them intaking more than 2 liters of fluids in a day. And you don't want them having any more than 2 grams of sodium in a day. So make sure you're restricting their sodium, their fluid intake, and they need to stop smoking. All right, so let's move on to the stuff they're actually going to ask you, which is your meds. So as far as treatment for heart failure, there's two different types of drugs in heart failure. It's going to be the meds that are going to stop you from dying or at least delay death, and then there's going to be the meds that are going to make you feel better. So there's four classes of meds that decrease mortality, and then there's a couple classes of medications that are just going to make you feel better, but they're not going to stop you from dying. They're not going to decrease mortality. So let's first start with the four classes of meds that decrease mortality. These are going to be beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, spironolactone or eplerenone, not used as much, and then hydralazine with your nitrates. The way you can remember that mnemonic that I came up with is bash the heart to make it pump harder, bash the heart to make it pump harder. BASH, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, spironolactone, hydralazine, of course, combined with your nitrate. And again, something that I didn't mention, the treatment that I'm going to go over is for systolic heart failure or decreased ejection fraction heart failure. So these are the meds for systolic heart failure. So again, your four classes to decrease mortality, decrease death rate is going to be beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, spironolactone, and hydralazine. Okay, so let's go into those meds and just go over a little bit about these. If you really want to dive deep into the farm with these meds, the MOAs, the contraindications, in my hypertension medication podcast and YouTube video, I go into all of these classics because they're using hypertension as well. So if you want a little bit more, but I'll go over the basics here, how they work and, you know, the indications and things like that. So let's start with arguably the best med for heart failure and to decrease mortality. That's your ACE inhibitors. So unless they're contraindicated, every patient with heart failure is going to get an ACE inhibitor and a beta blocker generally. So if you need to know two meds for heart failure, remember ACE inhibitors and then a very close second beta blockers. Almost every patient's going to get those classes. So best class overall for decreasing mortality and heart failure. It decreases ventricular remodeling, which is the myocyte hypertrophy that causes those baggy ventricles. It actually decreases that. And in addition, the other important thing that ACEs do is decrease afterload. So you decrease afterload, decreases the resistance, the workload that the ventricles have to face during contraction, and it helps them to pump more effectively. So really good meds, really the best med for heart failure. And one note that I want to make is that I say ACE inhibitors, but you can also use ARBs. Remember, ARBs work in a similar way. And in addition to ARBs, you can also use a newer med. I don't think you should memorize this for the boards, but it is a really good medication for heart failure, and studies are showing that it's probably going to overtake their ACEs very soon. And it's similar to an ACE. It's actually an ARB combined with what's known as a neprilysin inhibitor. It's called Entresto is the brand name. It's an ARB. It's valsartan combined with a medication known as salcubitril, and that's a neprilysin inhibitor. And this medication, they had a recent study. It was called the PROVE trial. It actually showed to not only decrease ventricular remodeling like the ACEs and the ARBs do, but in addition, it did show some actual reversing of the ventricular remodeling. So it actually reversed some of the ventricular remodeling. So this is going to be a med that one day will probably be the top of the line for heart failure. It's still too new. I don't know if it's going to be on your boards, but be familiar that Entresto does exist, and it's an ARB combined with that neprilysin inhibitor, and it works really well. So overall, ACEs, ARBs, and then if for some reason they did ask you, Entresto is another really big med mixed into that class. So that's your ACEs and your ARBs. And let's move on to really, like, say, the second line, second most important med for heart failure, decreased mortality. And that's going to be your beta blockers. So carvedilol, metoprolol, bisoprolol. This class is going to be started after you initiate an ACE inhibitor, as long as the patient is clinically euvolemic. You don't want to start beta blockers in a fluid overloaded patient, like in a patient that has acute decompensated heart failure, just going to make it worse. So otherwise, it's a great med to initiate in patients with heart failures and in heart failure. And the way that they help in heart failure is by decreasing activation of the sympathetic nervous system. So in patients with heart failure, they have this continuously increased renin and norepinephrine release. As the body's responding to heart failure, it's trying to compensate, and that's the way it's compensating. It's releasing epi, norepi, renin. It's trying to compensate for this heart failure, but eventually this chronic release of catecholamines are actually harmful to the heart, and it's what leads to ventricular remodeling and hypertrophy. And beta blockers, as we know, block the receptors for the catecholamines, so it decreases the detrimental effect on the heart, thereby decreases remodeling, increases ejection fraction, and ultimately decreases mortality in these patients. So beta blockers, remember, another really big one. As a side note, beta blockers, if a patient does have acute decompensated heart failure, are actually going to be discontinued. New research is showing they used to stop them altogether as soon as a patient would have acute decompensated heart failure. Now they're showing studies that say if they're already on it, they can continue. If they didn't start yet, you don't start them during that period. Because again, I told you it can make it worse because of their negative inotropic effect. All right, so a third class in heart failure that is shown to reduce mortality is the potassium-sparing diuretics, mainly spironolactone because it has a longer half-life, but a eplerenone can be used as well, just not as commonly as spironolactone. Remember, that's your S in bash the heart, B, beta blockers, A, ACE inhibitors, S, spironolactone in bash the heart. These meds decrease mortality due to their antagonism of aldosterone. Aldosterone, as we know, I've talked about this before, causes sodium and fluid retention. And in heart failure patients, these patients can be fluid overloaded, so you don't want to retain sodium and fluid. So potassium-sparing diuretics like spironolactone block the effects of aldosterone, decreasing sodium and fluid retention. So that's how they help decrease mortality in heart failure. And then the final medication in heart failure that can improve mortality is hydralazine combined with a nitrate. So both of these meds decrease afterload, which makes it easier for the weakened ventricle to contract. Nitroglycerin, in addition to decreasing afterload, also decreases preload. But so remember those meds. The main thing is the fact that they decrease afterload. okay, so those are the meds to improve mortality. Now let's go over the meds that don't improve mortality. They're not going to keep you from dying, but they make the patient feel better, which is obviously really important too. These patients can be, you know, having trouble breathing, feeling really crappy. So you want to make them feel better, obviously. So there's two classes that you should know: loop diuretics like furosemide, torsemide, and then positive inotropes like digoxin and dibutamine, which are used kind of really last line, but we'll go over those as well. So loop diuretics is the class you'll see most commonly used for symptom control. So meds like furosemide, also known as Lasix, these are the strongest class of diuretics there is. And as we've gone over before in the hypertensive lecture, they inhibit the sodium-potassium chloride cotransporter, the thick limb of the loop of Henle. And by doing so, they flush out a large volume of fluid, you know, because the sodium pulls out, and they decrease preload and they reduce peripheral and pulmonary edema. It helps the patient just to feel much better. It's because of all that fluid it's pulling out of the body. So loop diuretics absolutely is really the best medication for symptomatic relief. Now, the second class you need to be familiar with is positive inotropes. So the ones you'll see most commonly used is digoxin, but there's also dobutamine, dopamine. All these medications, the main effect of them is to increase the contractile strength of the heart. They're going to make the patient feel better by the heart pumping more effectively. They're going to increase the strength, the contractile strength. And really, like I said before, this class is reserved for last line treatment. It's when other classes aren't working because there's a number of adverse effects. Digoxin, which you've probably heard of before in your pharm class, it can cause so many adverse effects. It can cause visual changes, something known as DIG toxicity, which can lead to hyperkalemia, arrhythmia, so many problems with it. So really, once they hit class four is where you'll see some of these positive inotropes being used. And it's kind of like a last line med. Nothing else is working, so we'll try this. So again, symptomatic relief with those, but no decreased mortality. Okay, so those were the treatment guidelines for systolic heart failure, also known as heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. Now you're probably thinking, okay, so what's the treatment guidelines for diastolic heart failure with preserved ejection fraction? So you're going to be really happy to know, at least for the sake of not having to learn one more thing for your boards, is that diastolic heart failure, there's really not any treatment guidelines. Most studies directed towards the pharmacologic treatment for diastolic heart failure proved neutral results. There's really not one med that showed to be more beneficial or more efficacious than another class of medication. So generally, you're just going to treat the associated conditions, hypertension, AFib, and the symptoms like edema. So you'll see ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, loop diuretics, but there's no treatment algorithm like we went over with systolic heart failure. So really, they're not going to test you on it because you can't really ask any questions if there's not a guideline for it. So know the systolic heart failure meds, but for diastolic, just know that there's not really any algorithm or any guidelines to go by, so it's probably not going to be asked. And even if you look at like UpToDate, it says the same thing. There's really not any treatment guidelines for it. So just your general meds, beta blockers, ACE inhibitors, loops, but nothing specific. So don't even really worry about that. All right, and remember one last thing about the treatment. Outside of your pharmacologic treatment, there's some mechanical devices. So as these patients progress with heart failure, once they get to like stage four, their ejection fraction is under 35%. The treatment, in addition to pharmacologic therapy, is actually going to include a left ventricular assist device, which is an implantable device that helps the failing heart to contract with mechanical assistance. They also may have an AICD implanted, which is an automatic implantable cardioverter defibrillator. These are patients, again, in the last stages. And ultimately, once they get to stage four, death normally occurs within a year without a heart transplant. So once you get to that point, you just kind of use everything you can to preserve life as long as possible. Okay, so the last thing that I want to review before we finish is something known as acute decompensated heart failure. So this is the last thing. There's not too much to know. This is a sudden worsening of heart failure symptoms. These patients are usually going to come in completely fluid overloaded, dyspnea, pulmonary edema, rails in the lungs, peripheral edema, increased JVP, all the symptoms we went over just suddenly exacerbated by some underlying cause. So these patients are really sick. And ultimately can end in death from acute respiratory distress if it's not treated properly, and sometimes even when it is. So you're going to do your chest x-ray, your BNP, and BNP is actually pretty important for these patients, not only for diagnosis, but to track the response for treatment and to make sure it's declining. And a lot of times what cardiology will do when a patient's admitted, they're treating them, they'll track their BNP and won't release them in a lot of cases until it's declined less than 100. To show that they're responding to treatment. So again, that's beyond what you need to know for your scope, but just be aware of that. So the treatment in real life, it's a little bit more complicated than this, but for the boards, you just need to remember one mnemonic. And that mnemonic is LMNOP, LMNOP. So what does that stand for? This is really all you need to know for acute decompensated heart failure. So LMNOP, L stands for Lasix, furosemide right away. It's going to pull all the fluid off the lungs. It's going to help these patients breathe easier. You're going to give this intravenously. You need it to work quickly. So Lasix, also known as furosemide, is the LMNOP. Morphine, this is kind of controversial because, you know, morphine and other opiates were generally thought to reduce the work of breathing, decrease preload, even decrease anxiety in these patients to help them feel better. But the data just really isn't there to prove they're efficacious. So you may still see them being used maybe in some older physicians that always used it, but and it helps the mnemonic work, which is great. But generally, it's not used so commonly anymore. But that is the M in LMNOP. So you got to keep it there anyways. All right. So the N stands for nitrates. This is an important one. It's a venodilator, decreases their systemic vascular resistance, helps with left ventricular afterload, and nitrates are really important. And then the other last two, the O stands for oxygen. They obviously need oxygen. They're having trouble breathing. So they're only going to be with a non-rebreather mask at 100% O2. So that's the O in LMNOP. And then finally, P is for position. Normally, these patients are going to be doing this for you. They're going to be sitting up, kind of crouched over because it makes them breathe easier. And that's because when they sit upright and they have their legs hanging over the side of the bed, this decreases preload, which helps with the fluid overload. So position, if for some reason they are laying down flat, you want to make sure these patients are sitting up, have their legs dangling over the side of the bed, if it's feasible. If not, you have some other type of position so you can decrease preload. So again, LMNOP stands for Lasix, morphine, nitrates, oxygen, and then finally position. So that's the last thing that you need to know for heart failure. Let's do five quick questions and then we will wrap it up. So first question, name two classes of drugs that do not decrease mortality but decrease symptoms. What are two classes of meds that can help patients feel better, but they're not going to decrease mortality? That's going to be your loop diuretics like furosemide and then your positive inotropes like dobutamine. Okay, second question. Overall, what is the most common cause of heart failure? Most common cause of heart failure is going to be coronary artery disease like post-MI. Coronary artery disease, 60 to 65% of patients with heart failure. All right, what are the four classes used in systolic heart failure to decrease mortality? for classes used in systolic heart failure to decrease mortality. Remember, you're going to bash the heart to make it pump harder. That's going to be beta blockers, ACE inhibitors. Remember, your ARBs can be used as well as the Entresto, the ANRI, spironolactone, and hydralazine plus a nitrates. Remember, bash the heart, beta blockers, ACE, spironolactones, hydralazine plus the nitrate. What is number four? What is the most common clinical manifestation of left-sided heart failure? Most common clinical manifestation of left-sided heart failure, it's going to be dyspnea. Remember, the left side of the heart, lungs, fluids backing up into the lungs, they're going to have dyspnea, most common clinical manifestation. A BNP, question number five, a BNP above what level makes heart failure a likely diagnosis? BNP above what level makes heart failure a likely diagnosis? It's going to be over 100. Of course, remember all those side notes I said about BNP. You need to consider renal failure, obesity, things like that that can affect it. But a BNP over 100, you should be thinking heart failure is definitely a likely possibility in that patient. Okay, so that is heart failure. Thank you so much, as always. I know I said it in the beginning, and I'll say it every time because I do appreciate the comments. It really does make my day, and I just wanted to thank you again for that, and I really hope this is helping. It makes me happy to know that I'm helping you in PA school because I know how tough it can be. So as always, good luck on your pants, your pannery, your EORs, and good luck in PA school.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.